Okay, so welcome everyone to this evening's Dharma talk, which I've called Feeling and the Breath. The Theravadan monk and scholar Tenisiro Bhikkhu says, if you want the mind to settle down with any stability, it has to like where it's staying. I was quite struck by this statement when I read it and thought, I'd like to explore this a little more. And liking relates to feeling, of course. And feeling, as we've already started exploring in the practice workshops, it's such an integral part of Anapanasati practice. And so I'd like to explore this statement in relation to this object of meditation in Anapanasati that we've been exploring together, the breath. So when we think of the Dharma path, enjoyment is maybe not the first thing that comes to mind. Certainly hasn't been for me. As a natural dukkha-walla, many of you might relate to this, and someone who's trodden the path of insight for many years, for a long time I tended to ignore any mention of enjoyment or feeling good on the path. In fact, I saw it as unnecessary and something that was going to be like an obstacle on the path, a sign of getting stuck in desire. Anyone else relate to that? Yeah. But studying and practicing Anapanasati has shown me a different way to think about and frame pleasure and feeling good in practice. And I've come to understand the necessity of pleasure in cultivating serenity, this calm and non-agitated heart-mind. And actually, the Buddha's own awakening, his path to awakening, and all his subsequent teaching hinges on his relationship with pleasure, I think. And we looked at this last night in another aspect, but tonight I'd like to look at another part of the Buddha's story. And many of you are probably familiar with the story of Gautama, the Buddha to be. He grew up in a wealthy aristocratic household surrounded by abundant sensual pleasures, apparently. And after he left home for the contemplative life, he practiced with two masters of absorption meditation and reached deep states of samadhi. But then he turned away from this too, where he eventually finds himself at death's door after indulging in very rigorous ascetic practices, renouncing the body, renouncing pleasure of any kind. The Mahasachika Sutta tells how in his weakened, emaciated state, he realized that even after all these practices, he was no closer to finding release from suffering, to finding freedom of the heart. I think it must have been quite a shock, I imagine, for him to recognize the futility of all that effort that he'd put in, all those years of intense striving where he'd come to be known as Prince of Ascetics. And as Patrick touched on last night, he said no one had denied pleasure and trod the path as ruthlessly as Gautama had. So he'd sort of, he'd really done things to the extreme. And in desperation, he exclaimed, surely there must be another way. And a memory came to him of a time when he was a young boy. On a hot day, he was sitting in the shade of a rose apple tree while his father took part in a ploughing festival nearby. And sitting there, he spontaneously fell into a state of meditative absorption, jhana, in which a deep sense of peace and well-being and pleasure filled him. And remembering this all these years later, Gautama saw clearly that the pleasure he'd experienced on that day under the tree wasn't conditional upon seeking any particular external situation or stimulus. It arose from within a peaceful and settled heart-mind. And in many suttas, you see this passage, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unskillful qualities, I entered and remained in the first absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of seclusion, while placing the mind and keeping it connected. but even such pleasant feeling did not occupy my mind. So something shifted for him with that memory. He saw that his relationship with pleasure had been based on delusion. He was caught within a polarity of thinking about pleasure. So this worldview was based on an either-or paradigm, filled with desire and striving, one of either indulging fully in pleasure derived from the senses that he'd known in his early life, or of indulging in pain derived from denying and brutalising the senses. So what he saw now in his utter vulnerability and very close to death was that he'd been entangled in wrong view all that time. So he still hadn't managed to free his heart-mind. And this led him to ask, why am I afraid of that pleasure? For it has nothing to do with sensual pleasures or unskillful qualities. So this Buddha, the Buddha's come to a place of deep doubt, of real doubt here. He's confused, understandably. He was steeped in a culture and a worldview in which asceticism and denying the physical body ease and comfort was the norm. He would have been surrounded by other, you know, by fellow practitioners striving in the same way, other ascetics. And this is evident, I think, in the way that his five companions in asceticism reacted with disgust when they saw that Gautama had started eating food again. They left him saying, "The recluse Gautama now lives luxuriously. He's given up his striving and reverted to luxury because he'd started eating food." So one interesting question that Bhikkhu Bodhi asks in relation to this, and it's a good point, is why does Gautama not also recall the time when he first left home in his search and studied with the two renowned teachers, Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta, before he moved on and decided to practice austerities instead? Because Gautama clearly mastered these methods back then and knew states of joy and pleasure associated with those practices. So why does he recall instead his childhood experience here and not those of his more recent meditative achievements? And these achievements weren't insignificant because both of those teachers actually recognised his mastery and invited him to become the guru of both of those communities. And I think it's something to do with the purity and the innocence suggested by that childhood experience, that the Buddha is responding to something that arose naturally and is available without efforting, as opposed to the absorption practices he'd been engaged in that were part of a particular philosophy, a conceptual and metaphysical worldview. His experience under the rose apple tree was this spontaneous arising of peace and deep serenity. And the Zen teacher and poet John Tarrant says in relation to this childhood memory of the Buddha's, a kind of freedom was already present beneath whatever was happening. There was nothing to add, nothing to take away. And I think this is an interesting point. The deep pleasure to be found in practicing intimacy with life is just this. Whatever is happening, nothing to add, nothing to take away. And this natural pleasure is experienced right here in the body. And this pleasure is actually hardwired in us. We're naturally drawn to the pleasant and we resist or reject the unpleasant. So this was the image aroused in Gautama as the foundation point for his awakening and then his life's teaching, that there is actually nothing to fear in pleasure when it isn't rooted in wanting, aversion and delusion. The belief he'd been clinging to, that any and all joy and pleasure is to be shunned, was unwholesome because it was fueled by the very wanting, aversion and delusion he was trying to find release from. This is the paradox of his journey. And so we see then that the middle way teaching and worldview is seeded, and Gautama goes on to fully awaken soon after this. So as the story goes, Gautam is fed by the village woman, Sujata, who finds him unconscious on the path she's passing by on. She offers him rice milk pudding, according to the story, essentially saving his life. So again, feeling is highlighted here in the Buddha's story through Sujata's kindness and compassion, and in his open receptivity to her gift. And so I feel like these are both crucial conditions for his awakening. So what about our own relationship with pleasure? Do we shun it or think it isn't important to our waking up? Anapanasati encourages us to look more closely at our perceptions of pleasure, of ease, and importantly, our relationship with them. Because this is the starting point. We need to find some degree of comfort, ease, and good feeling in the body, in the breath, or in awareness, in whatever our meditation object is, so that we like staying here, yeah, in this experience, in this body. Remember Tanisaro Bhikkhu's statement again: if you want the mind to settle down with any stability, it has to like where it's staying. So if we like where we are, the body and breathing will naturally, well, easily settle and relax. Then the mind will calm and quieten down, which means the heart can then soften and open. So it's all conditional. And then, as we've been saying, with a relaxed body and a settled heart and mind, insight, you know, seeing and understanding clearly, can open up. And this is how these two wings of serenity and insight work together. So this is why the groundwork and the first satipatthana of body that we've been, you know, really exploring quite a lot in the last few mornings in the workshops are so important to cultivating a calm mind. It's all about our relationship and our worldview, if you like, with finding ease right here. But of course, when we talk about liking in the practice and talk about pleasure, this naturally introduces the problem of desire. So we learn that craving, wanting, is the root and the cause of all agitation, of all the suffering in our heart-mind. So there can naturally be a tendency to think, oh, so craving is bad, wanting, desire is bad. I have to get rid of it, I have to avoid it at all costs. So if I stay away from desire, I won't suffer. But we can't get away from desire. We can't escape from desire. We need desire on the path, actually. And the Buddha talks about this quite a bit. So the Pali English Dictionary translates the Pali chanda as desire, which means broadly impulse or excitement, intention, resolution, will. So when we desire, it's always in relationship to something. When desire is present, it's always desire or impulse or excitement for or about something. And importantly for our practice, this can be wholesome desire, kusala, or it can be unwholesome, akusala. So of course we need desire in order to just show up on the cushion, for example, to show up here on retreat, to want to know peace in our hearts, to keep meeting our dukkha. We need to want to do that. This is what we call wholesome desire, kusala chanda. It's desire for freedom from suffering, to wake up, to be liberated, to be happy, to live more wisely, you know, however we express that for ourselves, that aspiration. And desire can also be unwholesome. This is when desire shows up as wanting, craving, clinging, grasping. All these ways that keep us entangled in habitual patterns of pain and ignorance. So in this sense, when we're talking about akusala chanda, unwholesome desire, it's referred to as raga, passion or lust, or karma chanda, sensual desire. So this akusala chanda is desire that we imagine is going to bring satisfaction, freedom and happiness. But because delusion underlies it, it ends up bringing more pain. And we're all familiar with this. You know, we know these cycles, we know these habits, these patterns that keep coming, that we keep meeting in our lives, that we're working with to overcome. And we'll find that this desire is always rooted in identity view, me and mine. You know, this habitual I-making, my-making that we engage in to some degree. And all the agendas that the self keeps spinning out of habit. So then it's crucial on the path that we come to understand both unwholesome desire, what that constitutes, so that we can abandon that, leave it aside. And it's important that we understand what constitutes wholesome desire, so that we can nurture that and bring energy and right effort to our Dharma practice. So desire is necessary. It's what's part of what drove Gautama to leave home and a very comfortable life to pursue what he knew must be possible in his heart. And as John Tarrant writes about Gautama's plight, in spite of his wealth and ease, he's suffocating. His discontent is not merely a recognition of the human condition, but a raw suffering and desire, an impetus to see through, to see into, to see clearly, to see exactly. So this is a longing of the heart, you might say, something that speaks from the depths of us, that's very difficult to ignore. We have to want something to follow this path then. We have to want to keep following it. If we didn't want to do it, we wouldn't be here. And that's how wholesome desire works for us on the path. And so this desire, kusala chanda, we need right to the end of the path, because desire actually is part of the thing that keeps carrying us along the path until eventually awakening occurs and all desire drops away. It's not needed anymore. And we're free, at peace, all wanting extinguished in the supreme calling of the heart. So this is why desire and pleasure are so entwined on the path. We have to want to do it. And I think that we're only going to want to do it and keep doing it if it feels good in some respect. Otherwise, we'll lose interest and our gaze will return to Netflix or the news cycle or whatever's more compelling for us. And the Buddha once talked about this with a gathering of well-known clansmen who'd left home to devote themselves to a contemplative life with the Buddha. So he asked them if they delighted in the holy life. They all stayed silent. He asks them twice more, and they still didn't respond. I think this is really telling in this sutta. This is the Nalakapana Sutta, MN 68. I was wondering when I read this, were they afraid the Buddha would chastise them for enjoying the contemplative life? You know, is this the reason they all stayed silent? Did they think they shouldn't be feeling good doing this and delighting in this contemplative life? So he then directs the question to one of them. There's no escape here. So he asked one of them, Anuruddha, directly, "Do you all delight in the holy life?" To which Anuruddha answers, "Yes, yes, sir, we do." And then the Buddha affirms this response, saying, "Of course, it's proper that you delight in it. You're still young, in the prime of your lives. You could have gone off and indulged in a sensual hedonistic life. And yet you've chosen this. No one's forced you into it. You haven't been driven by debt or by thieves or by fear or by want of a livelihood in taking this up." And then the Buddha asks, "Did you not go forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness after considering, I'm a victim of birth, aging and death. of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I'm a victim of suffering. Surely an end of this whole mass of suffering can be known. Is that what you asked? And they said yes. Anuruddha says, yes, Venerable Sir. And then the Buddha asks for Anuruddha, so once you've gone forth into this contemplative life, what should you do? And he explains that if you don't achieve the joy and pleasure that are found in meditation, and he adds, or something even more peaceful than that, which is referring here to the stages of awakening, then your mind will still be occupied by the hindrances, by wanting, aversion, dullness and sleepiness, restlessness and worry and doubt. But if you do experience the joy and pleasure found in meditation, or something even more peaceful than that, then your mind will be freed from the hindrances, freed from agitation. So the Buddha's explaining here the main benefits of deepening pleasure in the path. When we cultivate natural good feeling within, in this meditative practice, then we're protecting our heart and mind quite naturally from unwholesome, unskillful mental states, from what agitates us. Or another way to put it might be, when you know a deeper peace, then obsessing with the hindrances, getting continually entangled in them, you'll naturally learn to abide there and leave aside the hindrances. You realise they're not worth getting entangled in. This is the ballast of serenity that we spoke about this morning. So this is one of the gifts of Anapanasati and the serenity mode of practicing. It sets up the conditions for us to get curious about and get to know, to embody good feeling that's natural. In other words, that's kusala, dharmic, and wholesome. So that when the hindrances do arise, then we're able to let them in and feel what's here with kind attention, with compassion, in the openness and receptivity of a heart and mind that's more naturally resting in joy, ease and pleasure. There's more cushioning, or ballast, I like to use that word, in the citta. And as one meditator said recently when she and I were discussing this, when there's calm and ease present, the more challenging things don't feel so big and sticky. In other words, they don't agitate the heart so much. So after investigating his question about pleasure, Gotama realised, I'm not afraid of that pleasure, for it has nothing to do with sensual pleasures or unskillful qualities. And in fact, as the Buddha then goes on to say, it's to be embraced, because this pleasure coupled with wisdom, so here the two, he's referring to the two wings of practice, serenity and insight, is actually what points us directly towards liberation. And he makes a strong statement. He says this kind of pleasure should be pursued, it should be developed, it should be cultivated, it should not be feared. So finding ways to like being here and feeling good in meditation is key to cultivating this serenity then, because it's going to keep encouraging the calming and harmonising of the citta. So what about feeling then in relation to the grounding object of breathing that we've been exploring this week? So this, the wholesome or kusala pleasure derived from practice is what the Buddha broadly calls sukha. And this is variously translated as happiness, ease, pleasure, rapture, bliss, or well-being. So you might see in those words how it's referring to a really broad and expansive continuum, if you like, of good feeling that we can cultivate in practice that doesn't depend on external pleasure-seeking. So sukha covers a pretty broad expanse of feeling, to cover this range because of our differences in individual experience and interest, but also because what we define as pleasurable or blissful as bringing happiness, ease, well-being, it changes over time. And it continues becoming more and more refined, more sophisticated, as our practice deepens. So if I think back to what I found pleasurable and brought happiness in my 20s, it's not what I find pleasurable and brings happiness now, thank goodness. My partner still plays very loud music, and I think about that quite often. It's like how I used to love loud music. You know, I'd spend a lot of time in my early 20s in nightclubs dancing, and, you know, the louder the better, right? And now it's very rare that I find that. I find such pleasure in loud music. So if you reflect on your progress on the path, if you've been doing this for a while, you might see this refinement occurring as wisdom and, you know, this our sensitivity ethically occurs, and our maturation, you know, our maturing in meditation actually happens. And I think it's good to keep reminding ourselves too that this is often an imperceptible occurrence. You know, that simile that I used the other night of the woodworker and with the ads and the finger marks in the ads, and how he's only realised years later that it's been worn away, but doesn't know when or exactly how that happened, but he's just seen that this has been worn away. So we can see, you know, this refinement, the sophistication of our and deepening of our meditation practice happening like this. Yeah. It can be very subtle sometimes, a lot of the time. So cultivating pleasure in Anapanasati can involve many different aspects, and it'll look and feel a different way to every practitioner, to each practitioner. But I think a few things that might be helpful to reflect on include the following here. So a confidence, and we might call this confidence or faith, to remind yourself, yes, I can do this. I can generate a degree of good feeling in my body in this experience of meditation, or in the breath, if that's what we use as our meditation object. So it's not something that we have to be familiar with already, this pleasure, or assume that it's something that's either here or not. You know, I just don't do pleasure. Yeah. Remember that serenity is a cultivation practice. You know, this thing that I said, you know, keep remembering that word cultivation. It's all about the doing, the doing, the doing. And even if we're not used to generating good feeling in the body, and, you know, this is a very common thing because of habit or because we live with trauma and we've not felt safe in the body for whatever reason, generating good feeling here in the body can be challenging. So this is a path that many of us tread. But I confidently believe that there's a way in for all of us. There's a pathway in to finding pleasure somehow in the body, to finding some ease here. And a related aspect of this is familiarity. To give yourself plenty of time to get to know what does feel good. Getting to know the breadth and range of pleasure in practice, even and especially the very subtle. Some of you might be experiencing this in the practice already, just to find the very subtle, you know, the sense of pleasure of just the hands resting together in the lap, for example. This can be very pleasurable, just to find that. So the important thing here, I think, is not intensity of feeling, but maintaining what good feeling is present over time. So it's becoming familiar with this pleasure. And sustaining the feeling over time is what will condition relaxation and calming of body and mind. So sensitivity is another thing that you can be mindful of. As the retreat goes on, become sensitive to the range and the nuance of pleasurable feeling in the body. So again, this is about giving yourself time to settle into the practice and familiarity with the realm of feeling. Because as we sit for longer periods, sensitivity naturally unfolds. And meditators often report this in relation to sound, you know, the sound of a meditator, you know, walking mindfully into the hall and sitting down quietly on their cushion can actually become a strong experience. Or the opening of the door, a classic one. So this sense of the body and the breath becoming more refined and more nuanced, and I'd say in terms of the realm of feeling, more wondrous. You know, can we tune into the delicacy and the refinement of what's happening when we become more sensitive and open to that, open to the wonder of that and feel the pleasure of that? Another aspect or quality that you might tune in with and play with is imagination. So imagination and creative play, I think, are really, really important in our meditation practice, in actively promoting feelings of pleasure in the body. So, for example, you might play with imagining the breath energy as light or gentle mist filling the body with each breath, for example. Or noticing that the breath energy is already here, you don't have to draw it into the body, but all you have to do with each in-breath is open to and immerse yourself in this benevolent life force. I mean, these are just what I call ways of seeing or ways of looking. They're a perception that we might bring, an imaginative perception that we might bring to practice that can open up this relationship with pleasure. And the important thing is here not to force anything to happen, but rather to use active imagination in the service of cultivating ease and pleasure. So it's play more, probably is a better word than imagination, play. And trial and error, experiment, try things out, play around and see what happens. So this is all about promoting and fostering skillful action to cultivate this wholesome action in our practice. And then we can also bring in different modes of attention. So we can bring a lot of creativity to awareness itself, and some of you have been reporting this in the interviews. So, for instance, you might narrow awareness down to one small area of the body that feels pleasurable. And, you know, the example I gave before was just feeling the hands resting in the lap, feeling that the warmth of the hands together. And you might just rest awareness on the pleasure of that, enjoying the sensations that are abiding there. And this can be a really helpful practice if there are sensations of pain or discomfort elsewhere in the body, or there's emotional or mental pain present. Where you let these uncomfortable sensations be present, and without pushing them away or diverting attention, you gently hold them within the frame of the pleasure or ease that you're feeling in the other part, in this other part of the body. So this, you know, again, this might be the breath coming, going, or just the hands resting in the lap. So we can receive the more challenging by resting into the pleasure of what's happening elsewhere in the body, and then receive the challenging as well. So again, it's calling on this ballast of serenity, of calm and ease, in order to be with something more challenging. Or you might start there with the easeful part and then play with expanding the lens of awareness out from that part. And as you do, imagining awareness drawing the pleasurable feeling out with it to other parts of the body, including the painful parts. So they're just some ideas around playing with modes of attention and playing with discomfort. And then rhythm. We've been talking about rhythm quite a bit the last few days. And for me, tuning into the rhythm of the natural inflow and outflow of the breath, it's like reading poetry or sitting in a beautiful wild place or listening to a moving piece of music, not too loud. Just noticing that the nuances of rhythm in the breathing can be a way to find ease. And I'd say what we're looking for in terms of pleasure is beauty. You know, we're looking for something beautiful here in the practice, and of course spaciousness. So sometimes meditators ask, But what about getting stuck in pleasure, in the bliss of meditation? Isn't that a trap, just the same as sensual pleasures? And yes, this is a distinct possibility. And this is where discernment is vital. We need to keep noting what's present, however pleasurable it is, so that we can keep progressing and not get stuck on the path. But the Buddha also taught that the pleasure found in the breath is a more refined, wholesome form of pleasure, or pleasure found in the body and awareness generally. It's a more refined, wholesome form of pleasure than those found via external or and sensual pleasures, for example. So if we do get stuck here for a while, it's not actually causing harm. And I think too that this is part of practice. This is part of how we learn in practice and life generally. We coast along for a bit and then we get stuck. We move freely again for a while and then we hit another snag. So getting stuck is only bad if we see that there's something wrong. But in my own experience with meditation, getting stuck, whether it's in meditation or in my art-making practice or in relationship, it's a necessary place for learning and further growth. And we were talking the other day in the staff room about edges and how the edges of things are often the most fertile. You know, like in natural environments, there's liminal spaces in natural environments where there's lots of biodiversity. There's this fertility there for growth, but there's often, they're often untidy, messy places, and there's lots of snags and logs and, I'm thinking of that image as I mentioned that. We feel like we're getting stuck, but it's important that we keep applying discernment here. This is the important thing, that we explore with investigation, with curiosity. What's going on here? This is the question we ask. This is when we get curious about what am I clinging to? What am I wanting here? Or what am I resisting? Am I wanting more than seeing here? This is one reason why the interviews on retreat are so important, that we get to reflect on our progress or our stuckness with someone else, and we get a perspective on what's happening. We can nut this out. So if we do experience rapture and bliss or any kind of pleasure and we keep wanting this, desiring this, the task is to notice this and importantly view it with insight. So there's discernment around the pleasure. And then we get to see the wanting more intimately. What's fueling the stuckness? And we understand the emptiness. We come to understand the emptiness of pleasure. In other words, it's fleeting nature. It's here, and then I get up from the cushion and I go outside and it's gone. We come to recognize that it's not my pleasure. It's not for me to control. Sometimes it arises if the conditions are right, and that's what we're exploring here in this serenity mode of practice. But then I sit down again looking for it and it's nowhere to be found. But if we keep relaxing into the practice, in other words, letting go of that wanting, that craving, realizing that we can't hold on to any of it, we'll find ourselves experiencing more sublime ease and happiness that's not so agitated and exciting, but more pleasurable still than this rapture that we want. And eventually we find a deep equanimity that's much more sublime and peaceful. So in Anapanasati, we don't stay with the breath just until we feel a sense of ease or pleasure and then switch attention to the pleasure and wallow in that. We keep tracking the breath at the same time as feeling the ease and pleasure, even as the breath becomes more refined and sometimes it virtually disappears. And this is the important part about why we keeping tracking this rhythm of the breathing right through the whole progression of Anapanasati, even when it becomes very refined. This grounding of awareness on the breathing keeps the practice balanced. It keeps serenity and insight balanced. And we'll keep exploring this in the practice workshops. As we stay intimate with the breath energy as it becomes more refined, we naturally open to the associated state of refinement that's happening with the body and mind generally. So we come to see that they're intimately connected and they impact each other. So whatever's happening with the breathing is going to be happening with the rest of the body and the mind. So in this way we can be with pleasure, but we stay with the practice aim ultimately, which is to experience insight, a deep and abiding letting go. And then we're doing this all the way to awakening itself. So this is what it means to be with pleasure, but not be overcome by it. And when we can be with pleasure and equally be with pain without being disturbed, we're free. So the encouragement during this retreat is to actively cultivate and welcome in pleasure and good feeling in meditation, because it will nourish the body and the citta, and this nourishment will keep providing a ripple of benefits in your life as well as in your formal practice, just as the Buddha promised Anuruddha. And just to finish with a quote from the Buddha, who said, in relation to finding deep peace in serenity, the Buddha says, when we find this deep peace and serenity, one could shatter Himalaya, the king of mountains, let alone this wretched ignorance. Okay, leave it there.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
You talked about getting up from the cushion and going out and, you know, changing the course. But there is also somehow that, I know it's like a trailing of this or of the serenity there.
Yes. Well. Yes. Definitely.
So I just.
Thank you for mentioning that. Yes, we don't leave it all behind. So, and that's what we want to keep resting into that pleasure that we find keeps, you know, is like the trailing, yeah? Because that's all part of cultivating serenity, is that we're building a world of experience. We're creating this world of experience. So no, it doesn't all disappear. But it's about recognizing that when something does fall away, you know, that the deep samadhi that comes on the cushion, that, you know, necessarily we have to leave something there behind when we get up, and that we don't hold on to that with clinging. In a grasping way, to recognize that it's conditioned and that it arises because of what we're cultivating, but that is always changing. So thank you. Go on.
I've been experimenting with inviting joy to become part of my awareness when awareness is seen as something separate from what you're aware of, but provides the lens through which you see it.
Oh, yes.
And that's been a very interesting process, and feels very different from talking about what happens when you're doing Anapanasati, because it's, for me, it's always been when I've been walking, and it feels much more it's a very tenuous thing, and then and then the sort of little drifts of it come in, and to recognise it. But I think the thing that struck me was that I hadn't noticed the absence of it.
Ah, yes, yes.
It wasn't that it was suddenly 100% nicer or better, it was just, I hadn't noticed it wasn't there.
Yes, yes. And so this is where we start looking more deeply at the refinement of the practice and how subtle it becomes, and starting to notice absences as well as presences becomes an important part of the practice. Yeah, and so and just to notice what does that feel like, you know, in the absence, what it feels like can be an interesting question as well. Yeah, thank you. So all these ways that we can play with bringing ease and joy and openness to the heart. All right. Thank you for your kind attention.